Well, so the question on the table obviously deals with two things. One, God, and two, belief in God. And I don't think we can completely separate those. That is to say, we form our beliefs about all sorts of things, beliefs about religion, politics, economic ideology, social attitudes, and so forth. And then we usually back into those beliefs after the fact, after we're committed to them, and find reasons why we ended up selecting those particular beliefs, that they are absolutely the right ones, even though these tend to be largely determined by where we happen to have been born, who our parents were, what our culture determined us to thank, our peer groups, mentors, friends and colleagues, and so forth. That's how it works. And in my case, I was not raised religious, but my peer groups in high school and college were religious, so I went down that path. I did go to Pepperdine University in California. It didn't hurt that it was in Malibu, California, I have to admit. But nevertheless, I took it pretty seriously and became a student of theology and took courses in the Old Testament, the New Testament, and the life of Jesus and the writings of C.S. Lewis and so on. And I became an evangelical, which by definition means you are evangelizing. You go door to door, sort of an Amway with Bibles. And but we did take that pretty seriously. And then later, when I became sort of a militant atheist, and I went around to those same doors and knocked on the doors. I take it back. I was wrong. And which sort of reminds me what you get when you cross an atheist with a Jehovah Witness is somebody who knocks on your door for no reason at all. Now, look, I can't possibly cover all of the arguments for and against God's existence in 20 minutes. To that extent, I feel a little bit like I have to take the posture of Henry VIII when he told his wives, "I won't keep you long." Basically, it boils down to this, that there are a set of mysteries that traditionally, we have been unable to explain, that historically have always been explained from a top-down, supernatural entity, being of some kind, that has always usually been called God or gods. And in the last 10,000 years, there's been roughly about 10,000 gods. So I presume most of you, like me, are atheists when it comes to Zeus and Thor and Ganesha and all the other thousands of gods that people have traditionally believed. And to that extent, you already know where I'm coming from, because you know that there's no evidence for those gods. They're socially constructed. They were part of the culture. People really did believe them then. They don't believe them now. We do recognize, all of us in the room, how that works. I'm just saying, it's okay to go one God farther. It's the same principle at work in the culture you happen to have been born in, how you were raised, the particular sets of arguments that are used after you already make that belief commitment, and so forth. Nevertheless, of course, those arguments are still made after the fact. Let me clarify one thing. Atheist, non-theist, agnostic, bright, whatever. The labels are problematic because it assumes that you already know what I'm talking about when I talk about this particular word. Atheism is just a lack of belief in a God. It isn't a thing to be. It isn't a position to take. It's not like a political position where we have seven planks that we adhere to. It's just, I just don't believe in God. That's it. So in the Q&A, don't ask me, do you have faith in atheism, or isn't atheism a religion? No, it isn't anything. It's just a starting point. No, I don't believe. Now let's talk about what we do believe. And if you want, in the Q&A, we can go about other things that we do believe, human rights or civil liberties or whatever. But that's not religion. That's politics. And if we want to talk about a particular religion, did Jesus rise from the dead? Was he resurrected? And so on. That's irrelevant to the question at hand tonight. Is there a God? There may be a God, and the Christian God is not the right God. There may be some other God, or maybe the Christian religion is the wrong one, but it's the right God. There's all those possibilities. That's also irrelevant. We just want to know, is there a creator of some kind? The arguments used boil down to really two general things that Immanuel Kant identified in the 18th century. That is, the starry heavens above and the moral law within. That's really what it boils down to. How do you guys, scientists, non-theists, secularists, whatever, explain the starry heavens above and the moral law within? In modern jargon, it's something like, where'd the universe come from? Well, the Big Bang. Yeah, okay, but what banged the Big Bang? How did that get started? what was there before the Big Bang and so on? Or how is it that the configuration of the laws of nature are in such a way that here we are? That is, atoms are structured in a certain way that give rise to molecules and biochemistry and life and so forth. Here we are. And then where does morality come from? Why would anybody be good without God? And then how does God act in the world? That is, it appears maybe there's miracles or unexplained mysteries that scientists can't explain, and that's how God works in the world. So let's go through these real quickly. The problem with saying, well, there has to be a cause to the universe that does not need a cause, why can't there be, and that therefore is God, that's an ancient argument, but why does there have to be some sort of entity that causes the universe? Why can't it be a non-entity? Maybe there's some other universe that causes universes. And of course the theist would say, yeah, but those universes had to be created by some non-universe type creator. And that gets us into an infinite regress, and that can go nowhere. Those are the kinds of philosophical questions I think that are best resolved over adult beverages late at night. Because ultimately I think our brains are too restricted, too limited in our capacity to solve those kinds of problems. So to me, a scientist, it doesn't offer anything to say God did it. Why not just say Zeus did it? It's a non-answer. That is, as soon as you step out of the realm of the natural and say, well, I think a supernatural entity did it. The word supernatural, it's just a word. It's just a linguistic placeholder for I don't know, or I can't explain it, or it's an unsolved mystery. We'll say it was a supernatural event. To use a slightly different subject, less controversial for tonight, the paranormal. It's another subject that we deal with at Skeptic Magazine, skeptic.com, the paranormal, ESP, psychic power, I'm reading your minds, and so on. And so let's say that it turns out, I don't believe that, by the way, but let's say it turned out that people really can read each other's minds. And let's say that we figured out a mechanism for it, explaining the paranormal. It turned out it's some quantum mechanic thing. It's like inside neurons, the little subatomic particles in the atoms inside our neurons collapse, and the wave function collapses across neurons in a sort of harmonious way. And there's this spooky action at a distance that we know does happen in quantum mechanics experiments, and somehow it leaves my skull and influences the neurons in your skull, and I can read your thoughts and you could read my thoughts. And now we know what the mechanism is. Let's say that turns out to be true. That's an actual theory, by the way. I'm not just making that up. Some stuff I just make up, but that one, it's actual real. That would no longer be the paranormal, right? It would just be physics, psychophysics or something. It would be a branch of psychology, a branch of neuroscience, a branch of quantum mechanics or physics or something like that. So the word paranormal is just a linguistic placeholder, much like when cosmologists and astronomers talk about dark energy and dark matter. They don't mean that as an explanation. It isn't an explanation. It isn't an answer at all. It's a linguistic placeholder that says, we're not sure what's causing the galaxies to hold together the way that they do. There's not enough stuff that we can see and measure at the moment to explain it. Therefore, there's something else. We'll just call it dark energy for now. The problem I have with theism is that that would be the answer for the theist. Oh, it's a dark energy, or God did it, or something like that. As if that's an answer. It's not an answer. It's a non-answer. It's a showstopper. It's a conversation stopper. If you're doing science and reason and logic and so on, we have to keep pushing further and deeper. What caused that? So that's the problem with offering something like a supernatural explanation. How do we explain the origins of the universe? God did it. That's not an answer. It doesn't answer anything. You know, don't you want to know how she did it? That alone tells us something about the cultural, psychological constraints on our thoughts about a deity. As for the fine-tunedness of the universe, well, look, it is pretty amazing how all the laws of nature are configured in such a way to give rise to atoms and molecules and inorganic chemistry and organic chemistry and self-replicating double helix DNA and so forth. But I think it's a little early in the history of science, only 4 centuries old, to say we now know enough about everything to say it can't possibly be explained by natural forces, therefore there has to be a supernatural force, even leaving aside my first argument that there is no such thing as a supernatural force. That's a non-answer. But even leaving that aside for a second and just say we can't explain it, how do you know? Before you say something is out of this world, let's first make sure that it's not in this world. And there's so much we still don't know about this world, by which I mean us, the universe, everything. So I think humility, modesty in the face of the great unknown is proper in this regard. We do have some explanations, by the way. There may be multiple bubble universes. The history of science shows us that, in fact, our perspective of the world gets constantly larger. We used to think we were at the center and the solar system was the entire universe, and just outside of the furthest planet were the starry heavens, the dome of heavens, and just outside of that were the angels and then God. And since then, over the last 4 centuries, the universe has gotten steadily larger. It has expanded. Physically, yes, it is expanding, but our thoughts about it have also expanded. So the idea that we're the only bubble universe, of course, is still restricting. How do you know we're the only expanding bubble universe? There might be multiple universes. And there is some reason to believe it's possible that whenever a star collapses into a black hole, a collapsing black hole itself creates a new bubble universe. This is one theory for the origins of universes. Why not ask that question and try to answer it scientifically? That is one answer. And to that extent, any universe that would have laws of nature configured in such a way to give rise to atoms would therefore have stars that collapse into black holes and create new universes, new baby universes, so they would be more likely to survive and create more universes that have those particular laws of nature. This is sort of a Darwinian selection process of universes. Those universes that have laws of nature that don't give rise to atoms don't create stars to collapse into black holes. They give rise to no more universes, and they're selected against, and they disappear. Now, that's still largely theoretical. There's some decent reasons to believe it might be true, but nevertheless, that's how a scientist thinks about these things. There's this theory, there's this hypothesis. We have to collect more data and test. We'll see. But that is one explanation for the fine-tunedness. And always in science, it's just okay to say, I don't know, and leave it at that. It's okay to have a tolerance for ambiguity and live with it. That's what we do in science. Third, the moral law, starry heavens above, the moral law within. Why should we be good? Where does the sense of morality come from? Well, I wrote a book about this, Science of Good and Evil, on the fact that we're a social primate species in which we have to get along with one another. We have to have some means of conflict resolution, some social forces and pressures that lead us to want to be pro-social, cooperative, altruistic, nice. And we are, most of the time, with most of our fellow in-group members. As you know, though, by watching the news on any given day or studying any period of history, we're also pretty dang tribal. And so it appears that we evolved through these Darwinian mechanisms, good evidence for this now because you can see it in primates, a propensity to be pro-social and cooperative and moral within groups, and fairly xenophobic, competitive, bellicose, and untrusting between groups. So we have within-group morality, between-group immorality, competitiveness. This is why I think, by the way, Old Testament law has much to say about that sort of thing. Love thy neighbor mostly means your fellow within group members, which is why you can read these nice moral homilies on one page and turn the page and it tells you to rape, pillage, and destroy those creeps on the other side of the river because, you know, they believed in the wrong God. So at least the New Testament's an improvement on that, but we can do better still, I think. Which we have over the last 500 years, of extending civil liberties to more people in more places, often in spite of religion, sometimes with the help of religion, sometimes in spite of religion. And so that's where I think morality came from. We can test this in people. You see it. People naturally have a sense of right and wrong. And so, too, does it appear that chimpanzees and even small, like capuchin monkeys with tiny little brains, the last common ancestor with them, maybe 15 million years ago, we do have social primates and all social mammals have some sense of a moral right and wrong. And, of course, culture tweaks it and so forth. Finally, this idea of God acting in the universe, acting in the world, miracles. A miracle by definition is suspension of natural law. So to one extent, us scientists have nothing to say about it because we study natural law. And by definition, a one-off event that could never possibly happen again unless a supernatural entity entered into our natural world and stirred up the particles somehow, cured somebody's cancer or something like this, cannot be on our realm unless you, the believer in miracles, can tell us exactly what happened so we can study it, analyze it somehow. So there are studies on this. Like, for example, do people that are prayed for get better faster than those who are not prayed for? Well, this has been a subject of deep study for the last 20 years. The evidence is overwhelmingly clear. No. Prayed for people don't do any better than non-prayed for people. And, of course, people knew this in the 19th century when Charles Darwin's cousin Galton did a study on the longevity of prayed-for people versus non-prayed-for people. The royal family got prayed for more than anybody in the entire country, and they didn't live as long even as commoners. So apparently it didn't work then, and the definitive study done and published last year, funded by the Templeton Foundation, a pro-Christian organization, showed conclusively that 1,800 heart patients, prayed-for group, non-prayed-for group, control group, and so on. The prayed-for group, not only did they not get better faster or anything like that, they did even slightly worse than the non-prayed-for group. The only explanation for this was when they found out that they were being prayed for by professional prayers, they thought, uh-oh, ooh, I must really be sick. And maybe that had a sort of a nocebo effect on them. And why is it that miracles always seem to be surrounding things that might have happened anyway, statistically speaking, I mean? First of all, you have the sort of bizarre kind of attribution of miracles, like, boy, I was about to board the plane and something happened and I didn't, and the plane went down, and I was saved. God really was looking after me. Yeah, but what about the guy that got on the plane instead of you? What, God didn't like him? Doesn't he have a family, people that love him, and now they're suffering instead of your family? What kind of a God would do that? Something like in 9/11, you see these stories, I turned left instead of right, and I was saved. What about the people that turned right instead of left? God didn't like them? I mean, what does that say about a deity? Is that a kind of God you'd like to believe in that would make those kinds of decisions for us? And I know many of you have probably heard this, and I know John has heard this, but it's not a frivolous argument. What is God a God against? Amputees. I mean, since the Iraq War began, we have in America just hundreds, if not thousands, of amputees. They've lost limbs. Most of them are Christians. Almost everybody in America is a Christian, right? So these are Christians praying to get better. They have Christian family members who love them deeply, praying for them to get better. Not one of them has grown a new limb. Meanwhile, God is busy causing tumors to go into remission, which, by the way, they just happen to do that on their own anyway. How convenient it is that the miracles always happen to be things that might have happened anyway, and then you back into it by attributing it to the particular God you happen to believe in. The amputee thing is actually pretty serious, and I'll finish with this. When I was in Perth a couple of days ago, I met a neuroscientist working on the regeneration of nerves, spinal cord nerves, to help paralyzed people. And I was encouraged to learn that we're actually making some pretty serious progress here by studying, say, amphibians that do grow, and reptiles that do grow new limbs. Well, first of all, if an amphibian could do it, couldn't an all-powerful God do it? Help these poor soldiers that fought for their Christian country and grow those new limbs? Apparently not. And if a salamander can do it, could we do it? It appears, yeah, we will be able to do this. Probably, if it's not 5 or 10 years, maybe it's 50 to 100 years. Whatever it is, we're going to do it. And in fact, this leads me to my final comments. If you go in search of an extraterrestrial, if you go in search of some sort of entity, a being of near infinite power, or even infinite power, what would you call a kind of an an extraterrestrial intelligence that we might encounter who is actually able to do genetic engineering and create self-replicating molecules, simple cells, complex cells, multicellular organisms. Look how close we are to solving a lot of these medical issues with stem cells, genetic engineering, now apparently regeneration of nerves. Just in 50 years of research, look how much we've been able to do. What might we be able to do in, say, 500 years or 5,000 years? What would you call an entity that could do that? Well, if you don't know the technology, you'd say, well, that's God. But if you know the technology, then it isn't God. And that's the problem of using any kind of science or reason or logic to try to reason your way to God, is you'll never find a deity. You can only find a super powerful, intelligent being like us, but just slightly more. And so with that, I don't see that there's any reason to believe in God. Thank you.
Many people think that reason and faith are opposed. God's existence cannot be proved by pure reason, they say, and so to believe in him is irrational. Not so. Take the universe. How did we come to believe in its existence? Was it that first we didn't know if it existed until someone proved its existence by pure reason? Of course not. All of us were immediately and directly aware of it. It was a given, and we discovered it by experience through our senses. Of course, we use reason and other faculties as well, intuition, our senses, and memory, to understand the universe, but our reason did not create it. Indeed, philosophy teaches us that it is very difficult, if not impossible, to prove the existence of the universe by pure reason. Yet none of us thinks ourselves irrational for believing in its existence. Similarly with God, ladies and gentlemen. The evidence for God's existence does not start with pure reason operating in a vacuum. It starts with God's self-revelation, to which human reason can respond to see if it makes sense and if it corresponds with reality. That self-revelation starts with the physical universe. The Christian Apostle Paul wrote, "For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made." That is, God has taken the initiative in designing this universe to express not merely his existence, but something of what he is like. The visible creation, of course, doesn't tell us everything about God. It shows his eternal power and divinity, so that we can perceive directly, intuitionally, and not initially by a long process of logical reasoning, though such reasoning processes will be vital in our subsequent understanding. And it is surely a self-evident fact that the universe exhibits unimaginably vast power, acknowledged by everyone without exception. And throughout history, mankind has also felt and expressed the stark contrast between the brief span of human life and the everlastingness, possibly, of the universe. Or at a sunrise over the ocean, when you are riding the back of a wave at Copacabana. Or awe at the Southern Cross as it hangs like a jewel in the midst of the multi-billion stars of our galaxy. Wonder at the cry of a newborn baby, or at the creativity of a Rembrandt, a Mozart, or an Einstein, is the window for many people into perceiving that this universe cannot be all that exists. There must be something beyond to which it points. My Oxford colleague Keith Ward once wrote, "To the majority of those who have reflected deeply about the origin and nature of the universe, it has seemed that it points beyond itself to a source which is non-physical and of great intelligence and power." Almost all of the great classical philosophers, certainly Plato, Aristotle, Descartes, Leibniz, Spinoza, Kant, Hegel, Locke, Berkeley, saw the origin of the universe as lying in a transcendent reality. They had different specific ideas of this reality, but that the universe is not self-explanatory and it requires some explanation beyond itself was something they accepted as fairly obvious. It is obvious, ladies and gentlemen. and perhaps demonstrated not least by the most recent World Value Survey showing that 80.1% of Australians believe there is a God or gods, and 5.3% were atheists. The source of the overwhelming power and beauty of the universe is God, and science has done nothing to diminish that impression. After all, science as we know it is the gift of the Judeo-Christian heritage to the world. Distinguished historian Edwin Judge of Macquarie University says, "The biblical doctrine of creation is itself the creator of the methodology of modern science. We don't hold the Greeks' perspective anymore, in spite of the fact that people keep looking back to Greeks as the origin of science. It is not the origin of science. The book of creation is the origin of modern science, the book of Genesis." And the Nobel Prize winner, Arno Penzias, who discovered the echo of creation, the cosmic background microwave radiation, tells us this: astronomy leads to a unique event, a universe which was created out of nothing, one with the very delicate balance needed to provide exactly the right conditions required to permit life, and one which has an underlying, one might say, supernatural plan. He subsequently added, very interestingly, "The best data we have concerning the Big Bang are exactly what I would have predicted had I nothing to go on but the five books of Moses, the Psalms, and the Bible as a whole." Ladies and gentlemen, this is a Nobel Prize winner. We are not talking about people at the lower end of scientific endeavor. And therefore, it is important to take seriously what they say. I've quoted a historian, a Nobel Prize winner. Now let's come to the world-famous philosopher, Anthony Flew, who was arguably Richard Dawkins' predecessor as the world's most famous atheist. He told me recently why he had abandoned his lifelong atheism, pointing out that the study of DNA had shown the almost unbelievable complexity of the arrangements that are needed to produce life, and he concluded that intelligence must have been involved. Physicist Paul Davis finds the impression of design in the laws and fine-tuning of the universe is overwhelming. These are not people who are thinking God is some placeholder. These are people who are advancing science and concluding from its advances that it's pointing towards the existence of God. We've heard Immanuel Kant quoted. For him, the reality of God was evidenced by the starry heavens above and the moral law within. We humans find ourselves in a starry universe, but we find that we are moral beings. And our behavior demonstrates that we believe that that morality is neither subjective nor relative. Saying to someone you shouldn't have done that shows that you expect the other person to share your moral code. That is, you both believe in a moral code that transcends the individual. But where does this come from? Dostoevsky said, "If God does not exist, everything is permissible." No, say the new atheists, we can be good without God, so we don't need him. Ladies and gentlemen, of course atheists can be good, and religious people can be highly immoral. Indeed, atheists often put to shame religious people by their integrity and their commitment to doing good. I am not suggesting for one moment that atheists cannot be moral. After all, it is my own Christian faith that teaches me that since all men and women are equally valid, equally valuable, and made in the image of God, they possess an innate sense of morality whether they believe in God or not. What I am saying, though, is that atheism does not explain how sane people regard certain things as absolutely wrong, like torturing little children. Richard Dawkins, incidentally, agrees. "It is pretty hard to define absolute morals," he writes, "on anything other than religious grounds." Well, it's pretty hard to define any morality if we follow him a little further. "The universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect," he writes. "If there is at the bottom no design, no purpose, no evil and no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference, DNA neither knows nor cares. DNA just is, and we dance to its music. Now, Dawkins later shows awareness that he is at the edge of a very steep precipice here, and he tries to draw back, suggesting elsewhere that we can rebel against our selfish genes, although he signally fails to tell us how we can do so if they and they alone determine our behavior. If an avalanche kills a skier, it makes no sense to call the avalanche evil. It just exists. If religious fanatics go to war, or if someone murders your child, how could you call them evil if they were simply dancing to their DNA? And what about justice? The new atheists react vehemently against the idea that God pursues justice after death. They stress the importance of seeking justice in this life. There are two things to be said about this. Prominent German thinker Jürgen Habermas, who calls himself a methodological atheist, says that Christianity and nothing else is the ultimate foundation of liberty, conscience, human rights, and democracy, the benchmarks of Western civilization. To this day, we have no other options. We continue to nourish ourselves from this source. Everything else is postmodern chatter. And the professor of intellectual history in London, John Gray, who is also an atheist, points out, the new atheists defend liberal freedoms without ever asking where they come from. However, ladies and gentlemen, if there is no final accountability after death, then by definition, fanatics, whether religious or secular, can shoot their way to oblivion after their mass murders and get away with it. According to atheism, no victim of religious or secular terrorism will ever see justice done. Their moral sense will prove to be the illusion that E.O. Wilson and Michael Ruse say it is, an illusion fobbed off on us by our selfish genes, indeed, to get us to cooperate. That, to me, ladies and gentlemen, is the moral outrage. And the Judeo-Christian heritage, which gave birth to our civil society, teaches us that justice will be done by God. Atheism offers us no such hope. Now, you may well object to all of this by saying that consideration of the stars and the moral law may well point to the existence of some vague deistic God like that of Einstein. But it cannot bring us further. You're absolutely right. So we must now consider another important source of evidence. I hold that God has not only revealed himself in creation and conscience, he has also revealed himself in history and experience, and in particular, supremely in Jesus Christ. The claim that lies at the heart of Christianity is that Jesus Christ is God incarnate, God encoded in human DNA, the Word become flesh. And the evidence for that claim is in large part historical, notably the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. We were told tonight that that is an irrelevant consideration. Ladies and gentlemen, the resurrection has been responsible for the faith of multi-million people in God throughout history. As a sheer fact and phenomenon, it has got to be considered as part of the given data. But you see, it's just at this point that something very odd happens. The new atheists profess to be interested in evidence, but their attitude to the figure of Jesus tells a very different story. Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens, and indeed Victor Stenger, whom I debated in Sydney this week, believe that the existence of Jesus is in scholarly dispute. The eminent classicist Professor Graham Clark of the ANU, who is not a Christian, writes, "Frankly, I know of no ancient historian who would have a twinge of doubt about the existence of Jesus Christ. The documentary evidence is simply overwhelming." Clearly, the new atheists didn't check, at least with historians, but they did check with some other people. In The God Delusion, Dawkins quotes a certain Professor Wells. Stenger quoted him to me the other night. But neither Dawkins or Stenger tell us that Wells is a professor of German in London. What would Dawkins think, I wonder, if I got my information on biology from a professor of Mandarin? I mentioned the resurrection in my debate with Richard Dawkins, and he thought I had taken leave of my scientific senses. Had not David Hume long since exploded the possibility of miracles by showing that they were violations of the uniformity of nature? Actually, no. Hume, in fact, was completely inconsistent. He did not even believe in the causality that is necessary for the formulation of a law of nature. And he was wrong that miracles violate the laws of nature. If you put $200 plus $200 in your bedside drawer tonight and you find $100 tomorrow morning, do you say that the laws of arithmetic have been broken? No. You say the laws of Australia have been broken. You see, it is the fact that you know the law of arithmetic that enables you to recognize that something has come in from the outside into the system. So it is at the higher level. The laws of nature are not causes. They are our descriptions of what normally happens. Those regularities have been created by God, but God isn't a prisoner of his laws. He can feed a new event in by his power. No one is claiming that the resurrection of Jesus happened by natural processes. It happened by a colossal input of divine power. So, excluding the possibility of miracle, making nature and its processes an absolute in the name of science sounds very impressive. But as C.S. Lewis pointed out, if all that exists is nature, if our own deepest convictions are merely the byproducts of an irrational process, then clearly there's not the slightest ground for supposing that our sense of fitness and our consequent faith in uniformity tell us anything about a reality external to ourselves. If the deepest thing in reality, the fact which is the source of all other facthood, is a thing in some degree like ourselves, if it is a rational spirit, and we derive our rational spirituality from it, then indeed our conviction can be trusted. Science cannot tell us, and I'm glad that Dr. Shermer agrees, that the resurrection of Jesus is impossible. To decide whether it happened or not is a matter of history. And ancient historian Dr. John Dixon, who's director of the Center of Public Christianity, draws attention to the work of Joseph Klausner and Pinchas Lapide, two of the 20th century's most acclaimed Jewish scholars. Klausner says, the disciples must have seen something, as it is impossible to suppose there was any conscious deception. Lapide said more. In a purely logical analysis, the resurrection of Jesus is the lesser of two evils for those who seek a rational explanation. To deny the resurrection simply leaves the church without a raison d'etre, which is historically and psychologically absurd. Professor Moll of Cambridge says, if the coming into existence of the Nazarene rips a great hole in history, the whole, the size and shape of the resurrection, what does the secular historian propose to stop it up with? The birth and rapid rise of the Christian church remain an unsolved enigma for any historian who refuses to take seriously the only explanation offered by the church itself. Now, finally, some of you may feel this has been very one-sided. Surely the evil perpetuated by religion is enough to disprove the existence of God. And I'm ashamed as a Christian of what has been done in Christ's name, particularly since he forbade the use of force and violence, and therefore those who used it are not his followers. But ladies and gentlemen, getting rid of religion, to get rid of its abuse, is like getting rid of money to abolish greed. But all of us need to face the reality of suffering, whatever its motivation. This is the hardest question of all. If you abolish God, of course, you solve the intellectual problem. But as we've seen, you simultaneously remove all hope. I have a problem because I believe in God. I don't think there are simplistic answers. However, I do think there is a window of hope. I ask you finally, ladies and gentlemen, to think of one major implication of the resurrection. If it's true, Jesus Christ is God incarnate. His crucifixion is a fact of history, and it raises a profound question. What was God doing on a cross? And that shows me at least that God has not remained distant from the problem of human suffering, but has become part of it. And then I remember what Alexander Solzhenitsyn said. The line dividing good and evil cuts through every human heart, including me. The cross of Jesus Christ not only gives me hope that evil will one day be conquered, it shows me that God loves me enough to deal radically with the guilt of my own heart, to forgive me and give me a living relationship with Him. It is the experience of that relationship for over 40 years, ladies and gentlemen, that is for me one of the most powerful evidences of the reality of God, and that is true for millions of other people. Thank you very much.
Mind, Michael, John?
Yes.
It's the same question, in a sense, on the inverse. And we'll start with Michael. Michael, what piece of evidence, formula, piece of reasoning, whatever, what would cause you to believe in God?
A deposit of $10 million in a Swiss bank account under my name.
That's a really hopeful answer.
And yeah, I know.
And if it comes true, I think I'm there with you. And perhaps as glib, we may get an answer from John on, in a sense, the same question in inverse. What piece of evidence, mathematical formula, piece of reasoning would cause you to abandon your belief in God?
Historical evidence that Jesus Christ had not risen from the dead.
Can you describe the form that would take? I mean, we've already got $10 million out of it.
I would want you to describe it to me because, I mean, you've suggested that's the kind of evidence that I would expect because my faith is based on evidence. It's not based on anything else. So evidence is crucial for me.
My question could be answered by either of the two debaters. I suppose they'll both get a chance. I am very curious, especially for Dr. Shermer. Do you believe in the existence of the mind? That is to say, the existence of immaterial things, mental events, numbers, values, laws that appear to govern propositions, like the propositional laws of logic. And if you do affirm the existence of the mind, how do you do that in a strictly materialistic mm-hmm. sense, mm-hmm. assuming, of course, that you are not only an atheist, but also a materialist?
Mm-hmm.
One
yep.
final point.
Yes.
Oh. If you are able to give, a second part, if you are able to give a materialistic explanation, can you please explain how logic emerges from matter, and how should we trust our thinking about these things?
Oh, that's enough for a conference. Off you go, Michael. You have 30 seconds. No.
I always like it. You only get one question. Okay, I have one question in two parts. In fact, I did host a conference at Caltech on that very subject that lasted a whole weekend. Well, in short, mind is a word to describe behaviors, actions, particular cognitive processes, and so on. It's a little bit of a fuzzy word that most neuroscientists are uncomfortable using. And therefore, I think it's better to talk about specific things, like you have a particular kind of thought that drives a particular kind of behavior. What is the cause of that? And then we can track that down through fMRI brain scans, through neurochemical analysis by injecting people with oxytocin or norepinephrine or dopamine and see what kinds of behaviors are changed. So it's still strictly a materialistic worldview, a bottom-up process that explains a higher-order emergent property of a complex system. No different than an economic system, an ecology. Consciousness is an emergent property of a billion neurons firing in particular patterns and nothing else.
John, would you have anything to add to that?
Well, I admire this man's faith. I really do.
Not using the F word.
I am, yes. Conscience is nothing but a firing of a billion neurons, but there's not a scrap of evidence for it. Asking the neuroscientists in Cambridge, in Oxford, sorry, they tell me no one knows what consciousness is. No one even knows, ladies and gentlemen, what energy is. And I think what really this question illustrates is the difference between our two worldviews. The one worldview starts off with matter-energy. And because it doesn't believe in anything transcendent, it is forced to confine all explanation to be ultimately reductionist and totally bottom-up. And I think that that leads us to an absurdity, actually, because you cannot explain the immaterial things that you've mentioned, which really do exist, of course. We live in the information age, and information is not a material quantity, and some physicists even think it's fundamental. And I think it's easy to illustrate, and I've tried it out on many scientists and get the same answer every time. I ask reductionists to explain the semiotics of the letters on a menu, say, which says roast chicken, in terms of the physics and chemistry of the paper and ink. It cannot be done. You cannot explain the existence of something that carries meaning without inputting an intelligence. So that the biblical notion, in the beginning was the Word, makes far more sense to me than the notion, in the beginning were the particles. And we have to decide which of the two worldviews makes sense. To my mind, the first one undermines rationality on which I do science.
John, if you have a stroke in the Broca's area of your left hemisphere, you will lose language. Language, all this beautiful higher order, God-given stuff, it's gone if the neurons are dead. That's it. It's neurons. It's nothing more than neurons. If you have a stroke, you kill those brain cells, that's it. The function's gone.
But
it doesn't matter. You can pray, whatever. It's gone.
But the point... You've got a marvelous cheer group here, haven't you?
Well, you got this guy right here. Yes. He's louder.
The neurons...
Let's move along your answer there, John.
No, well, just the simple fact that if you take writing on paper, the things that carry the information are physical. And, of course, if you damage my brain, that will cease to exist. But that is not an argument to saying the two things are the same thing. That's like saying the meaning of the writing is the same as the page of the ink in the book. And that's absurd nonsense.
Can we move on if we agree that... Can we move on if we agree that in the beginning there was a roast chicken? No. Which answers the old question of which came first, the chicken or the egg? And I'm not going to get into evolutionary dynamics at this particular point of the evening. Sir, a question at the back.
I'd like to ask Dr. Lennox to expand upon his theory of God, and being a scientist, he knows that such theories must be self-consistent. Now, we know that under his theory, God created the universe something like 13 billion years ago. We also know that God revealed himself to mankind for the first time about 2,008 years ago. We also know, under that theory, that God must have a brain the size of a planet, since he's capable of listening to 6 billion prayers at the same time and acting on them. So my question for Dr. Lennox is, what did God think about for the first 12,999,998,000 years?
Here's an easy one for you, John. The mind of God for the greater part of the existence of the universe. And you have 30 seconds.
Size and length of time do not determine importance and significance. Ask any woman about the importance of the tiny little bit of diamond on her finger about that. And the interesting thing that science has revealed is this, that in order to get a universe like this, you have to have several successions of star evolutions and so on. So the age of the universe and the length of time and the vast distances, it could just be, couldn't it, that what science is revealing about the fine-tuning of our universe is that we need all this in place to get this window of human history available. Of course, neither you nor I can answer the question, what is in the mind of God? But my faith tells me one day I'm going to find out. Atheism, of course, is not going to find out.
Well, wait. If there's a God, I will find out, right? I mean...
I think some in the audience
corrected.
Might suggest that by then it's a little too late,
to
Michael.
Right.
By then it'll be a little too late.
Yeah, well...
we have another question up the back here.
And so in supposing that DNA and in God's creation everything is perfect, then how does Christian doctrine account for genetic diseases and things like that where DNA is immediately damaged in some way or a child is born with the DNA that is damaged? And for people who are perhaps not born into Christianity and who grow up in a life where they aren't exposed to the concept of original sin and so on, what kind of a God would then have people grow up on the earth without this knowledge and then expect people to then follow that morality under a Christian belief system without the privilege of the knowledge that Christians then carry with them to then fulfill this?
That's not really a two-parter, is it? It's actually two completely separate questions. So let's start with the first question, and seeing as we've thrown the last two, we've started with John. Let's start with Michael. Michael, the question of an imperfect universe, is that or is that not the hallmark of a creator God?
Oh, it's entirely possible that God does exist, and he's just a nasty bastard that likes to screw up people's lives. An evil God, a God, that's not so good. That's entirely possible. I mean, there's all kinds of different variations of gods that there might be. The God that John believes in, however, we have a problem explaining why he would have let those sorts of things happen. Not human evil, where people do bad things to one another. That's free will. Okay, I can buy that. But why innocent children should die? Why would a God allow that? And again, what's God got against amputees? What's with that? Can't do it? Just hasn't figured out, mastered neuroscience yet? Why would he choose not to do it, yet choose to do other things? And I'm sorry, I just don't accept the God works in mysterious ways answer. That's not an answer.
John. The imperfect universe?
I mentioned in my introduction very briefly that this is the hardest problem. That is very clear. And when people, and perhaps some of you in the audience, have suffered, it is a problem that needs to be handled with extreme care. I have the problem because I believe in a God of love. And if I did not believe that there was going to be ultimate justice, I would immediately leave this lectern. This is a damaged world. We're all aware of it. And any philosophy that doesn't have regard for that damage is seriously wrong. And one of the things that disturbs me about the new atheism is it is a utopianism. It seems to believe in the perfectibility of humanity. It has no real answer to this, except to say that's exactly what you'd expect if the universe was simply the product of blind chance and necessity. I believe that's not the case. I think if you look at a cathedral that's been bombed, you can see evidence of its original structure and beauty. And there's not one of us who hasn't seen that this universe doesn't just present a one-sided picture of unmitigated disaster and evil. It presents a mixed picture. And so my question is this. Are there sufficient grounds for trusting God in the midst of a universe that's got ragged edges? And that's what brings me inevitably to the point where I finished my introduction. Without the cross of Christ, it makes no sense to me. But if God has really come into our world and taken part in our human suffering, I find there enough evidence to trust him, even when there are major problems. Let me just briefly illustrate this. I nearly died last Christmas, and it fits in with what Michael was saying earlier. And the medics got to me in the last minute, and they saved my life. But last year, my sister's 22-year-old daughter died of a brain tumor. I was spared, she wasn't. And if I didn't feel my Christianity was robust enough, it's all very well, and Michael's dead right. He's absolutely dead right. This nonsense of saying, wonderful, I was spared. I've got to have something that I can talk to my sister about, where she and I can both understand, one, the thankfulness that I didn't die, but help her to get to grips with the fact that she lost her daughter. And these are very difficult things, but I have discovered in my experience that faith in Christ and God has given people a bedrock of hope and enabled them to go through that kind of trauma.
And that is the concept of what's the point of original sin if there are many people in this world who will never be exposed to that concept and therefore condemned to hell.
Ah.
If that's a reasonable parody.
Are you
of the
asking
question.
Me or Michael?
We'll start with you because it sort of does follow on from what you were just saying in a very crude way.
I believe, as you've seen, in a God who's fair. God will never judge anyone for not having evidence that they couldn't have. That would be absurd, morally absurd. He will never assess anybody on the basis of something they've never heard of. And as for condemning to hell, ladies and gentlemen, I think we must notice that these words have got all kinds of connotations. I believe in a God who has dignified me and you with the capacity to choose. And if I choose to say no to God, God will allow me the implications of that choice. He'll allow me not to have him. Otherwise, we'd be accusing him of forcing his way into our lives, which I understand many people don't want. And of course, not to choose God, that is what I understand it to be, what is subsumed under the biblical notions of hell. We need to get rid of a lot of the medieval imagery, but we need to take it very seriously. If we want free choice, and we all believe we do, it's one of the most important things that we possess as human beings, then to suggest that God would force us against our choice, of course, is not the God of love that I know. It's the question of love, isn't it, that allows choice? And I have children, three of them. I brought them into the world. They didn't choose to come into the world. I didn't choose to come into the world either. I took the risk, ladies and gentlemen, that my children would grow up to reject me. Now, why did I take that risk? Is it worthwhile? Well, you parents will know. There's the possibility of love, but there's only the possibility of love if there's the fundamental freedom to say yes or no. So there's always the risk that no will be said. And I think God, in one sense, if I might say it reverently, faced a similar problem and has provided a solution in Christ for when the thing goes wrong.
Paul, can I get
connected? Yeah, I was about to say, Michael, have you got anything to add to that one?
Got an extra minute there. Well, John's statement about his near-death experience and that tragedy of his sister is deep. That was powerful, beautiful, almost sonorous. And it reminded me of a few years ago, I had the opportunity to have Thanksgiving dinner with Isaac Hayes, the great musician, American musician.
The chef. Right.
And Shaft, theme from Shaft.
It's a beautiful thing.
And he was a good friend of my best friend in Atlanta. And so I got to sit right next to him at Thanksgiving dinner. And I knew he was a Scientologist. And I think Scientology is one of the sort of sillier beliefs that people hold. Nevertheless, I was curious to ask him, why? Why are you a Scientologist, without being disrespectful? And so I asked him, you know, why are you a Scientologist? And he said, well, Michael, I've gone through a number of tragedies in my life. I've lost everything that was near and dear to me, my family, you know, my income, my everything, my home. I had nothing. And they helped me. And those beliefs saved me. They really made me feel better. They built my life back up. That was it. I had nothing more to say about it. I mean, it doesn't really matter at that point if that's what makes him feel better and helps get through the veil of tears that life sometimes can be. But that is irrelevant about whether the beliefs claimed by Scientology are true or not. The beliefs in Xenu, the galactic warrior who 70 million years ago came from another planet and planted humans and volcanoes on Earth. This is what they believe. And none of us here, I assume, or hardly anybody, would probably believe that. Nevertheless, that still makes them feel better. So what a religion does to make you feel better psychologically and help get through life is quite a separate question from whether there really is a God or not.
Can I just comment on that? He's absolutely right, ladies and gentlemen. Absolutely right. It is.
Can you guys stop agreeing with each other?
No, but for the sake of the audience, it is very important to establish that. He's absolutely right. It doesn't determine truth. But I just want you to notice the same argument applies to atheism. If you argue that religion's a comfort and it helps and so on, that's nothing to do with its truth. You'd say exactly the same of atheism. So we've got to break out of that, and that's why both of us, as I understand it, are actually interested in evidence.
No, that's why I said atheism isn't a thing to be. It's nothing. It's just, I don't believe. That's it.
Do you believe that, do you?
Let's,
ladies and gentlemen.
No calling out from the audience, thanks. There are microphones for you to call out through, and gentleman has been waiting at this microphone.
Am I allowed to ask Michael a question? Oh, we'll have this gentleman.
Yeah, all right.
No, I'm very puzzled, and I've heard it from Richard Dawkins too, and Christopher Hitchens, that atheism is a nothing. It's simply the belief in a negative, that there isn't a God. And it's like not believing in Wotan, and I'm an Azusist and all the rest of it. Well, I certainly am an Azusist, ladies and gentlemen. And atheists say they only go one God further. Well, that's like saying that there's not much difference between marriage and celibacy. It's just one relationship less.
Not for all marriages.
I didn't mean that as a substantive point. The thing is this. Richard Dawkins and Michael Shermer and Christopher Hitchens have not written 400 pages on Awotanism. Because atheism, although he's perfectly right, it is belief not in God, has a whole set of positive entailments. And as far as I understand, Michael can correct me, his positive philosophy is either materialism or naturalism. That is why he is expounding it to us tonight. And to say atheism is a nothing is, well, I simply don't comprehend it. It is a belief system which includes a negative belief in God and a whole set of positive beliefs. Ask him if he believes atheism.
Okay, quick, so we can move on.
No.
Atheism, is it belief or disbelief?
It's just simply, I don't believe in God, that's it. I mean, when you talk about, yes, I believe there are natural forces at work, that has nothing to do with atheism. I also believe in liberal democracy and free markets. That has nothing to do with atheism either. This is just, you have to specify which particular claim you're making and why you believe it.
We have a question up the back. Participation is good. We have a question up the back, and I'm just going to have to take a brief leave of the auditorium. I'll be back in just a moment. So, your question?
Question in one part.
All day.
Dr. Lennox, you mentioned that Richard Dawkins quoted a professor of German on theology and how that was absurd.
No, on history. History.
Wasn't it German?
No, he quoted. Let me get this straight.
Excellent.
He was discussing the question and saying in his book that the historical existence of Jesus is in dispute among scholars. The only authority he cited to prove his point was a professor. That's what he said, Professor G.A. Wells of London. He didn't tell us that Wells is a professor of German. He didn't contact any ancient historian and therefore made a colossal faux pas in his book. And that undermines my confidence because, you see, ancient history is a discipline where we can check. And if people claim to be interested in evidence, then to do that kind of thing is simply inexcusable. That's the point I'm making.
Okay, now before I go, I want everybody to be nice and clean on this.
I didn't get to my question.
If you wouldn't mind asking a question, and then I'll let you rip.
Excellent. Because a little bit later on you quoted historians for saying that it was impossible that there was any possible cognitive error, and I wonder how a historian could come up with really something would be more of a psychology.
There you go, guys. That's got to keep you guys going for 5 minutes. I'll be right back.
Paul, don't forget to turn off your microphone when you go to the little room.
I got caught on that trick was with Douglas Adams.
It
was
oh, yes.
Very embarrassing.
The answer is 42. I have something to say about that, actually, John.
Yes, please.
I mean, so Dawkins quoted the wrong guy, or he didn't cite him right, or said, this is just trivial matters. And whatever experts you happen to be citing, you cited Anthony Flew, is baffled by DNA. So what? So he's baffled by it. There's a lot of scientists that aren't baffled by it, and they're atheists. What difference does it make? How many Australians, 80.1% of Australians believe in God? What's the number, John? 49.9, and then you're going to change your mind? I mean, it's irrelevant how many people believe something. As I said, millions of people believe in Scientology. It's irrelevant how many believe in it. It doesn't matter how many accept Christ's resurrection or what. It's totally irrelevant. These things are either real or they're not.
That's absolutely right. They are either true or they're not. We don't prove things by statistics. But it is interesting to see of our fellow human beings, all of whom I take seriously, what they have decided in this matter. And to say that human belief and its distribution is irrelevant seems to me again to be a question of not feeding all the evidence into the pot. It's not very important evidence. I just gave it as a toss away. It's not very important, I agree with you. But let's not ignore evidence. I don't agree with you, by the way, that this matter of the existence of Jesus is a triviality, because Hitchens does the same, Michel Onfray does exactly the same. It is an attitude that Noam Chomsky has recently commented on. And he says the most dangerous thing in the intellectual sphere today is people who pride themselves and say they are interested in evidence, but when it comes to things that other people believe, they do not make the elementary check on evidence. Now, I have discussed the resurrection, for instance, with Richard Dawkins, and he simply said, I just don't understand how you could possibly be interested in it. And yet it has shaped the faith of millions. It's the historical cause behind the rise of the Christian church. To say you're not interested in it is fine, but then don't talk to me about saying that you are keen on evidence.
Next question, madam.
Dr. Lennox made a couple of points about, basically said that without God there's no justice or hope. You seem to be making a big assumption that there should be justice and hope. Like, what are you basing that on? Why should there be justice or hope that we don't just create for ourselves?
So we don't have anarchy.
Hang on. No calling out, please. Over to you, John. Should there be justice and hope? Why do you believe that there should be justice and hope?
Every human heart has a moral sense. I've stood in Auschwitz many times. I'm not sure that you would ask that question so easily in Auschwitz. The whole question of the screaming of women as they were tortured to death for justice. Now, there's either an answer to it or there isn't. What I'm arguing is simply based on what Richard Dawkins says, He appears to believe that the universe at bottom is no justice, and yet he's morally outraged at Christianity and religion and all the rest of it. Where does he get this moral high ground from? The question as to why there should be justice is not really the right question. The right question is Michael Shermer's question. Is there justice? Is there real morality? Or is it an illusion? The new atheists believe it is an illusion, and therefore they have no grounds for morality, although, of course, as I've emphasized, my atheist friends are marvelously well behaved and I respect them. But the basic grounds is a different matter. And you see, somebody actually shouted out from the audience the need for it for society. Michael Shermer said exactly the same thing on the basis of evolution. Alexander Solzhenitsyn died 2 weeks ago. And what he said was this, and I'll never forget it. He said, if you asked me to express briefly why it is that 60 million of my fellow countrymen perished in the last century, I would simply say we have forgotten God. That's why I'm interested in it.
Yeah,
justice in this life is important. That's why we have civil laws. We got them from Christianity originally anyway.
In the First World War, John, tens of millions of Christians killed tens of millions of other Christians. They didn't forget God. They had God und wiss us. Their God is with us on their belts. So apparently that didn't, not abandoning God didn't slow him down.
Are you right?
I do have an answer to the Dawkins question that you said.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
I'm dying to hear it. Thank you.
I somehow doubt it'll satisfy you, but Michael does have an answer.
It might. I'm always open to evidence, you know.
We have to remember that this business of the selfish genes, this has been largely misunderstood. In evolutionary biology, when we talk about the success of a species, it's becoming more adaptive to its environment and so on. It doesn't mean getting faster, fitter, as in stronger and better and smarter. It means whatever it takes to get your genes in the next generation. It may be that becoming slower and smaller and dumpier and uglier and whatever, that's what it takes. And it isn't just selfish, cutthroat, nasty, brutish behavior that leads to more successful getting your genes into the next generation. In social mammals, it means being extremely cooperative, pro-social, altruistic. That is, having a moral sense within your group, with your fellow group members. I'll give you just one simple experiment. It's a very famous experiment called the trolley problem. It's now been done so much, it's called the trolleyology. Anyway, so you're walking down a track, and there's a split in the track, and there's five workers down one side of the track, and the train is hurtling down. They don't see them. The train's about to hit them and kill them all. And you're standing there at a switch. If you throw the switch, the train will go down the other track where it will kill one worker. All right? Do you throw the switch? How many of you would throw the switch, kill one to save the five? Really? You just let five die? Okay, so in experiments like this, most people say they'd throw the switch. Second scenario is you're standing on a bridge over the track. The train is hurtling down. It's about to kill the five workers who don't see it coming. Standing next to you on the bridge is a great big guy, you know, like Paul. And if you throw him off the bridge and he lands on the track, the train hits him, kills him, you've saved the five workers. Would you throw him off the bridge? Maybe I shouldn't ask that for
him. Answers, please, ladies and gentlemen.
And almost everybody says they would not. And there seems to be something deeply ingrained in us that it is wrong to throw somebody physically, directly, direct action kills somebody, and yet more people are willing to flip a switch. We've seen that. It's easier to kill people from a distance with a gun than it is with your bare hands, right? So there seems to be something deeply ingrained in our natures. And that has to do with the fact that we're a social species, and it does matter how we feel about other people. We do have a sense of right and wrong and justice. And there's a whole body of research on this now showing not just in humans, but all non-human primates show this as well. So we evolved a moral sense.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's...
May I comment?
How could I possibly stop you, John?
Well, you've got all the authority in this room, sir. Michael's been quoting the very well-known work of Mark Hauser, which Richard Dawkins uses as the God delusion to argue that you don't need God to be good. The switch tracks dilemma is one we commonly use in ethics to show that people of all kinds of different backgrounds and so on tend to have the same inbuilt morality. And I'm grateful for him for mentioning it, because it proves exactly the point I was making earlier. That is exactly what you would expect if Christianity were true. Because Christianity teaches that every man and woman is created in the image of God and therefore is a moral being. And so you'd expect there to be a common pool of morality around the world. What I don't understand, and I've read Richard Dawkins and Selfish Genes, and I take what you say, Michael, is perfectly correct, but I'm interested that, and I was quoting Dawkins himself, who said, that all accepted, we've got to rebel against the selfish genes. And various atheists, not just believers like me, have taken him to task, asking him what immaterial element is there in us to rebel against those selfish genes. And also, the evolutionary explanation of morality falls down a bit when it comes to genuine altruism. Why bother looking after the weak and the rest of it when the weak are not even of your own tribe and species? And I would just point out again, it is the historical fact. It was the Christian faith that looked after unwanted children in the early Roman Empire, gave us hospices, hospitals, and so on and so forth. So that it seems to me that what he said actually fits in very well with what I myself believe.
Do we not see hospices, care of the sick and the injured in, say, Buddhist society?
Oh, we do, yes.
Hindu society?
Well, we do, yes, today. But in our Western world, that's true. I'm not denying at all. You see, it springs from this fundamental belief that men and women are equal, created in the image of God, and of a real moral sense. Therefore, there are many atheists today who are caring and involved in building hospitals and so on. I'm simply pointing out, as a matter of history, it was Christianity that freed the slaves. It was secularism, actually, that brought slavery back in the 19th and 20th centuries. So that...
Not quite. The abolition of slavery, okay, sure, there were some Christians who got behind it, reluctantly dragging the rest of the Christians along with them, who reluctantly went along with it because their financial interests were to do so. I mean, the great story of the, you know, the British slave abolitionist, Wilberforce, this stands out as a great story. There's a film made about it, the guy that wrote Amazing Grace. It stands out to me because he was the only one. These guys are all Christians who he couldn't convince. It took him decades to convince. So it isn't like Christianity was behind this the whole way. It sort of reluctantly got drug into it as the modern world shifted toward more and more inclusiveness of more people to be considered as human.
Yeah.
Let's... Dr. Lennox, if he is aware of the young Earth people who present a creation science story which basically wipes out evolution entirely, and what he thinks of such things as the young Earth evidence produced by a radiocarbon disequilibrium in the upper atmosphere. One quote.
I'm not only aware of them, sir, I come from the very city in Ireland. I've got to make a public confession here.
Please, go ahead. I feel like a priest, actually.
I almost don't say this before this audience, but I shall. I was come from the city of Armagh in Northern Ireland. That's where Bishop Usher came from, you know.
Right.
Yes.
But that doesn't answer the, say, the radio...
No, but I'm coming to the point.
Sorry.
I'm coming to the point. Your first question was I aware of it? I am exceedingly aware of it. That's the first thing. And you will find, quite rightly, that you will find that there are Christians equally convinced of the reliability and inspiration of Scripture who differ on these matters. I myself, as you know, am a scientist. Wearing my science hat, I am very impressed by the evidence of people I've cited tonight, like Arno Penzias and so on, that we live in a universe that's around 15 billion years old, give or take a year or two. I find, and I want to word this carefully, because some things can be very hurtful. I find, as a Christian, that the Bible in its Genesis account is very much more sophisticated than some people allow. The issue at stake in the exposition, of course, is the nature of the days in Genesis 1, as you very well know. Now, people say, do you take them literally? Well, the word yom in Hebrew in Genesis 1 has four distinct meanings. They are not the same. And that, to anybody that knows anything about literature, is a wonderfully interesting warning sign that this is highly sophisticated language. The Bible says that in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. It then gives a sequence of days. You cannot even argue from the text, whatever you believe about the days, that in the beginning was part of day one. So what I'm arguing, and I would need to develop this for another 20 minutes, but I'm not going to do it. What I would want to argue is, I take Scripture extremely seriously. And because I take it seriously, I find myself very much, both from a scriptural and a scientific standpoint, agreeing that the earth is as you say it is. I have no difficulty with that whatsoever. If you want further explanation, then you'll have to give me
by order, the book.
It's not
right.
Fair. It's not in the book.
Do you want a co-author, actually? Michael, have you anything to add to that?
Well... Never pass up an opportunity to say something. John, I don't know why you keep quoting Arno Penzias or Anthony Flew or anybody. It's irrelevant. I don't really care who said it.
So you're not interested in what scientists at the top level of science believe, Michael?
Okay, well, here's...
Is that what you're saying?
Here's a stat for you. Even though the AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, about 40% of those believe in God.
That's
only
right.
7% of the National Academy of Science, which are the most elite, the most illustrious, the most productive and smartest scientists, only 7% of them believe in God. So if you want to play the stat game, how many believe is going to shape which one we pick, I can cite far more Nobel laureates who don't believe in God than do. It's just kind of, but it's irrelevant.
But no, it's not. The very fact that there are Nobel laureates on both sides of the question show us that it's not science abolishing God. It shows us that there are two worldviews, materialism or naturalism and theism. They are the diametrically opposed things. I don't think science and religion are opposed at all, nor did the founders of science. The worldviews are opposed. And it seems to me that that simple fact, the Human Genome Project, first director Jim Watson, Nobel Prize winner, second an atheist, second director Francis Collins, a Christian, that very fact ought to tell us that the problem lies far deeper in. And I find it extremely helpful to observe that. Otherwise, you'd think, listening to some people, that all scientists ought to be atheists and no non-atheist should be a scientist, and that just isn't the case.
Let's move along because we are running out of time. Another question over here.
Dr. Lennox, St. Augustine said that reason is the enemy of faith. And I would like to ask you a question with regards to original sin. Why would you choose to worship a creator God who forbade man to actually eat from the tree of knowledge, one which you have obviously eaten from because you are a rather knowledgeable man? Why would you choose to worship this sort of deity who would have kept you dumb?
That's a very good question. I'll tell you why it's a good question. I notice it was asked originally by a snake. That is not implying any offence at all.
None taken.
Because, well, let me try to answer your question. The story in Genesis fascinates me because it is a story that defines for us what life really is. It defines it at its various levels, from the physical to the aesthetic, to family life, to work. And the highest thing in life, according to that story, is a relationship with God that's morally determined. And the issue was whether human beings could trust God or not. So there were two trees, as you know. The scene shows us the basic minima necessary for a moral being. Something forbidden, but freedom to take it. Now, what was the issue? The enemy said, has God really said you shan't eat of all the trees of the garden? Nonsense. And then he pointed out what you've pointed out to me. God wants to suppress you, you see. He wants to keep you down. It'll cripple you intellectually, aesthetically, and everything else if you go for this tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And so they did, and they ate the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. There are two ways of knowing good and evil. Notice, not a tree of knowledge, by the way. God was very
keen. In Hebrew, it's called the Etz Hadat, and Dat means knowledge, not good
yes.
or evil.
And is good or evil not mentioned?
No, it is not.
At all.
Not
okay, I stand corrected there. I'd like to find out about that afterwards. But the fact that God is clearly not against knowledge is clear elsewhere in that very text, because God actually started science by encouraging human beings to name the animals at the beginning of Genesis, which is what we call taxonomy. Now, to just very briefly wrap up on this, the notion that believing in God keeps you down is very common today. I was told when I was 19 by a Nobel Prize winner. He said to me, do you want a career in science? I said, yes, sir. He said, give up this childish notion of belief in God. It will cripple you intellectually completely, and you'll never make a career in science. I quietly said to him, sir, what have you got to offer me that I haven't got? And he talked about emergent evolution. The answer to your question, though, is this. Is God, do I worship a God who wants to keep me down? Tell you the kind of God I worship. I worship the kind of God who made me in his image and coded himself into humanity, came into our world to provide a basis through his death and resurrection that I could become something that I was not by creation, and that is a son of God. And the basic message of the Christian faith is a magnificent one, that God is prepared to give the individual who trusts Christ his very life, and that that person rises in that sense and is given all the potential of God to be able to enjoy his friendship. The capacity of enjoying friendship with God is the biggest thing in my life, and it will be the biggest thing eternally. The notion that God is trying to keep us down is actually the original lie. It's just lovely that we have these public freedoms to do this kind of thing. As you will have noticed, I have disagreed with him profoundly over many issues. I get the impression from his introductory speech that he believes that he thinks that I believe in a kind of God of the gaps, in scientific terms, a placeholder. I do not. I believe in the God who grounds the whole endeavor of science. And it seemed to me that he constantly makes the mistake that Richard Dawkins and others make of confusing agency with mechanism. So that believing that God is ultimately responsible stops science. That's absurd. The rise of science in the 16th and 17th centuries came about in a Christian framework. And those early scientists didn't say, when they discovered, say, the law of gravity, we've got a mechanism, we don't need God. They worship God more because of the genius of the mechanism. I see God not in the bits of the universe I don't understand, but in the bits that I do. The question was raised about the old chestnut that I used to get a lot in Russia, but I now get it in Britain from Richard Dawkins. You know, this infinite regress business, if you say God created the universe, who created God, and so on. But that works both ways. Richard Dawkins believes the universe created him. So quite legitimately, we can apply this question to him, can't we? If he insists on asking who created God, I can ask him who created the universe, but he won't allow me to ask that question. So he's inconsistent. But secondly, ladies and gentlemen, and more importantly, if you ask the question who created God, it shows you believe in a created God. None of us believes in a created God. That is a real delusion. And I suggested to Richard rather naughtily that if he'd written a book called The Created God's Delusion, he wouldn't have made very much money. So it seems to me that it's very important that we sort some of these things out. And the basic issue, and it's an important one, in this question, who created God, is this. The buck will stop somewhere on both sides. You either stop with matter and energy, which has been capable through unguided processes of producing a universe, of producing life, of producing rationality, and of producing the idea of God, because there isn't a God. Or else you believe, I'm not quite finished. I see a row of skeptics in front of me. I'm not quite finished. Or you believe that matter and energy are not primary at all, they're derivative. And we start with, in the beginning, God. I want my final point. Have I got a moment?
You certainly have.
How much time have I left?
You've got another minute and 40 seconds.
Oh, that's very generous.
Make that 42.
We have been faced with someone talking who is a distinguished skeptic. As I understand it, the word skeptine is a Greek word that means to check from a distance. And skepticism is very important, and Michael has demonstrated in many of his books the pseudosciences that we need to get out of our thinking. But ladies and gentlemen, we may start with a skeptical approach to Christianity. That would be wise, to check it all out from a distance. But there comes a point when you have to give up your distance. You see, if I had been skeptical about my wife all her life, she'd never have become my wife. I did check her out at a distance to start with. But then, in order to make that profound commitment that has now lasted 40 years, I gave up my distance and approached a person. And belief in God, ladies and gentlemen, is not belief in a theory, because you can keep approaching theories from a distance. Belief in God is in the end commitment to a person. And you can never know the reality of that kind of commitment unless you give up your skepticism and, on the basis of the evidence you've accumulated, you start to commit yourself to a person. You won't know everything, but I have tried to argue that there's enough basis in science, in history, in philosophy, in God's self-revelation to be at least a platform from which we can begin to give up our skepticism and enjoy a positive relationship with the God that created us to enjoy himself eternally. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
But also because he is actually celebrating his 40th wedding anniversary. That's got to be worth a round of applause. We will conclude with a 5-minute rebuttal from Michael Shermer.
Thank you, row two. And again, thank you to the Australian government for bringing me here from California for National Science Week. And it's been a great trip. I've still got one more leg to Darwin. So I guess we've talked a lot about atheism tonight, and I started off by making a comment about labels and definitions. I guess one label I saw that maybe best sums up what I think is a bumper sticker that said, militant agnostic. I don't know, and you don't either. And I think we've dealt, obviously, with a lot of huge, heavy questions here tonight that I don't know, and John doesn't either. None of us know. I mean, why is there evil and suffering, and what was there before the Big Bang, and things like this. It's okay in science to just say, I don't know. In fact, that's one of the sort of joys and beauties of science, is that, you know, we don't know, but maybe we'll find out. Maybe you get to figure it out. Maybe I can figure it out. We'll all work on it on this journey together. And so I think I'd like to just wrap up by reading a few paragraphs from my book, Why Darwin Matters, on what the scientific worldview tells us and where you can get a spiritual sense of transcendence from it, from this materialistic scientific worldview. Does a scientific explanation for the world diminish its spiritual beauty? I think not. Science and spirituality are complementary, not conflicting, additive, not detractive. Anything that generates a sense of awe may be a source of spirituality. Science does this in spades. I'm deeply moved, for example, when I observe through my 8-inch telescope in my backyard in Pasadena, in L.A., you can still see stuff. The fuzzy little patch of light that is the Andromeda Galaxy. It's not just because it's lovely, although it is, but because I understand that the photons of light landing on my retina left Andromeda 2.9 million years ago, when our ancestors were tiny brain hominids roaming the plains of Africa. So what science tells us is that we are but one among hundreds of millions of species that evolved over the course of 3.5 billion years on one tiny planet among many orbiting an ordinary star, itself one of possibly billions of other solar systems in an ordinary galaxy that contains hundreds of billions of stars, itself located in a cluster of galaxies not so different from the millions of other galaxy clusters themselves, whirling away from one another in an accelerating, expanding cosmic bubble universe that very possibly is only one among a near infinite number of bubble universes. Is it really possible that this entire cosmological multiverse was designed and exists for one tiny subgroup of a single species on one planet in a lone galaxy in that solitary bubble universe? It seems unlikely. Herein lies the spiritual side of science, the scientuality, if you'll pardon an awkward neologism, but one that echoes the sensuality of discovery. If religion and spirituality are supposed to generate awe and humility in the face of the Creator, what could be more awesome and humbling than the deep space discovered by Hubble and the cosmologists and the deep time discovered by Darwin and the evolutionists? Darwin matters because evolution matters, and evolution matters because science matters, and science matters because it is the preeminent story of our age, an epic saga about who we are, where we came from, and where we're going. Thank you.